You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, August 31st, 2015. My name is Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting to you live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal.
And the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, a twofer. Malcolm Harris. He has a piece out in Al Jazeera, The Unfunny Business of College Humor. Is it really a crisis of political correctness on college campuses, or is it a boring student activities cartel limiting what comedians and other performers perform on college campuses? Also, State Representative Matthew Lesser of Connecticut. We're going to talk with him briefly about the student loan debt relief fight, how it's shaping up in the 2016 election, and the leading role he played in Connecticut on getting this important issue on the national agenda. What else we got, Matt?
Also on the show today, we have tons more for you. Updates on the clown car.
Yes.
We have a wonderful story about Obama going to Alaska, and he is going to do something great that's very respected, that's very respectful, that's the word I'm looking for, to the native people of Alaska.
Yes.
And of course, because of that, Republicans have a real problem with it.
Specifically, Ohio Republicans.
Yes. Why would Ohio Republicans be so interested in Alaska? You will find out on today's Majority Report.
We'll also probably get to some of the sound that's sitting around. There's a lot coming on today's M&M Monday on a sleepy August 31st. We will be right back with Malcolm Harris.
I got a bone to pick. I don't want you monkey mouth, 'cause sitting in my throne again.
Hey, it was headed back in the hood.
I'm mad, but I ain't stressing. True friends, one question. Where you and I was walking, now I run a game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta, everybody wanna cut the legs off him. Kunta, black man taking no losses.
Oh, yeah.
Where you and I was walking, now I run a game, got the whole world talking. King Kunta, everybody wanna cut the legs off him. When you got the yams,
what's the yams?
The yam is the power that be. You can smell it when I'm walking down the street.
Oh, yes, you can. Oh, yes, you can.
I can dig rapping. But a rapper with a ghost rider. What the f*** happened?
Oh, no.
I swore I wouldn't tell. But most of y'all sharing bars like you got to buy the bunk in a two-man sale.
A two-man sale.
Something's in the water.
Something's in the water.
And if I got a brown nose for some gold, then I'd rather be a bum than a mother.
We are back on the Majority Report.
I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Malcolm Harris. He's a columnist for Al Jazeera America, and we're talking about his new piece, The Unfunny Business of College Humor. Malcolm, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Michael. Thanks for having me.
It's my pleasure. So there's been a lot of talk recently, starting a couple last year, I think, an interview with Chris Rock for New York Magazine, where he said college campuses have essentially become too uptight, to really perform in and enjoy performing in. It's safe to say when Chris Rock said that, I certainly was pretty interested in what he had to say. Then Jerry Seinfeld followed up himself. And as usual, when Jerry Seinfeld talks, I'm not really that interested in listening. And then it's kind of become a cottage industry of, you know, college campuses are too uptight, they're too tense. And there's a big piece in The Atlantic recently, which you sort of responded to. And in your take on what's happening in college humor is a little bit different. You're talking about really the financial incentive structure that sort of sets a context for who gets booked and who doesn't. So could you explain to us a little bit the business of college comedy and college humor?
Yeah. When we talk about comedy on college campus and we think about schools bringing comedians to campus and musicians and artists or whatever, we still think of colleges as sort of in the small liberal arts mode of they're bringing small acts to perform. But when we're talking about big colleges, and the article by Caitlin Flanagan at The Atlantic was talking about the National Association of Campus Activities, where the bookers there are looking for big acts, and they're paying big money for mainstream comedians. These aren't people who are just trying to make it. This is more money than you'd get paid to perform a comedy show just in a good club, for example.
Right.
So these are really sought-after spots. And whenever you've got this much money being spent on something, there are gatekeepers that develop, and there are institutions like the NACA that see a spot for them to exist between the student market and entertainment that they're trying to bring to their school.
So get us into the specifics of this. I guess Caitlin Flanagan, she did write about this in her piece, the National Association of Campus Activities, and the way she sort of framed it was that these are the sort of gatekeepers of political correctness on campus. And what you sort of framed it as is that these are basically the sort of junior ministers or junior bureaucrats of taste who are guarding large budgets and are sort of like a representatives of basically more analogous, not so much to political correctness, but the same way somebody might make a very conservative conservative programming choice for a primetime sitcom, that it's about money and it's not about offending people versus, you know, a sort of political agenda.
Yeah, I think people are thinking about colleges in the wrong way. I went to the University of Maryland, which has, I think, 37,000 undergraduates. And when you're talking about appealing to that many people, you're not talking about an institution where people are all very similar. You're talking about a city, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're programming municipal arts festival, let's say, you're not going to go with the most out there comedian you can find. You're going to find someone funny who's going to appeal to the widest number of people without offending any particular group within that audience. And that's just what we see these sort of like student council types doing at the NACA. I mean, these are kids who have volunteered. Some of them volunteer to work for the NACA like part time and actually put in a lot of effort doing this for no money.
Wow.
Other kids have given up their weekends to go and watch, you know, comedians try out for their student council.
And what kind of students would be spending their weekends this way?
Right. Well, I think that's a fair question. And I think in my experience, and I think everyone's experience, people who get involved in student politics, in the administration of student politics, where you're dealing with budgets and booking acts like these, tend to be people who have their future very set out and who want to do this professionally, who want to make decisions for large, large groups of people. And this is how they learn how to do it, how they learn how to be inoffensive and pick people who aren't going to bother anybody.
So I guess arguably then what you're saying here is that this could apply just as equally to – so in a certain sense, the sort of narrative is like, you know, this is why you know, a provocative, politically incorrect comedian doesn't get booked, or this is why, you know, a sort of out there show that might offend some sensibilities doesn't get booked. But I guess by the criteria you're setting out, and I would love to know if you had examples of this possibly, this could also mean that, you know, we wouldn't book like, you know, I don't know what a good example would be. I don't know, a black nationalist comedian or somebody who would, you know, from a very different perspective, make another set of people deeply uncomfortable. Is that your point, that this is just sort of this broad kind of flattening?
It's like when you think about people you get for graduation speakers.
Mm-hmm.
They tend to be the blandest, most, you know, some small schools that are committed to a particular political point of view might get Mumia Abu-Jamal or someone. But mostly you're going to see public officials, you're going to see uncontroversial entertainers, the biggest, least offensive names they can get, because that's how you operate a bureaucracy of that size. But that doesn't mean, I think it's a misconception that radical performers or out there performers of all sorts aren't getting booked at colleges. I think they are. They're just not going through organizations like the NACA. Instead, there are student groups that reach out to them in particular.
Okay, yeah. So I think there's some pushback on this that we'll get to, and maybe some counterpoints to your argument. But before we get there, explain to us that you – this is another part of your piece in Al Jazeera, is that there's this whole sort of ecology of people getting booked from across the political and ideological spectrum, and also just – people doing more provocative and more interesting shows that are certainly still showing up on college campuses, but they are not sort of sponsored by student activity committees. They're sponsored, as you said, by different student groups. And that's sort of like bypassing the gatekeepers a little bit.
Yeah. Well, there's a big market for student activities. And some of it is spent on these big student-wide performances that are inoffensive and kind of tame, but a lot of it is spent by groups that are small and with a very specific focus, and they might throw a public performance, but it's going to be driven by the interests of people who are passionate about a particular issue. Or even if you've got like a theater on campus that screens weird movies because the people who run the programming committee are weird theater kids or movie kids, not bureaucrats. I think the most radical culture is probably still on college campuses, notwithstanding the NACA and organizations like that.
So how do you contend with, though, and because I don't want to dismiss all of these concerns out of hand, because I definitely know people who are, you know, more progressive, left-wing comedians, performers, they don't want to do college campuses. I will say, I've already said, from my kind of personal bias, I guess when Jerry Seinfeld, you know, he was upset that he couldn't do his, like, you know, gay French king iPhone bit, which is, you know, really shocking that that wouldn't kill on a college campus. You know, like, yeah. I don't know what to say about that. And as you said in your article, if there's less of an appetite for sort of, you know, lame gay humor, then, you know, that's also just a reflection of kind of evolving taste and people having less patience for, you know, maybe homophobia and lameness, hopefully. But I think when you talk about, you know, when Chris Rock said that, I did think that that was interesting and kind of revealing, because this is a guy who obviously, I think arguably, is certainly the best stand-up comic out there today. He's someone who... you know, does, and he also said something that was interesting in that quote, is he said that you can get to an inoffensive place through being offensive, which is a really interesting way of putting it. And it does seem, and then, you know, you take it as an example, and I've been extremely critical of Bill Maher on this show about things that he said about Muslims and Islam. But, you know, I don't know if UC Berkeley students not wanting him to be on stage is really, like, you know, the answer to that. It doesn't seem healthy. It doesn't seem kind of flexible. So do you think that there is an element at all to these arguments, that there is just this sort of hypersensitivity and sense of needing to sort of be played to at all costs? Because that's kind of, Caitlin Flanagan's argument in The Atlantic, and I agree that it's a really overblown piece, but her argument is that this sort of fits into a broader pattern of college becoming just sort of like a consumer product. And, you know, I don't want to see or deal with anything that could bother my, you know, cushy experience, from the food to the performers. Do you buy any of that?
I think there's a really interesting sort of play that's going on there in this idea of students as consumers who mm-hmm. are complaining. When we talk about consumerism and consumers, usually the picture of that is, you know, mindless sheep and people like accepting what they're told. Mm-hmm. Since when is it a hallmark of consumerism to constantly refuse what you're given and demand something different? What they're doing is not acting like consumers at all. Acting like consumers would be for them to say, you know, thanks, whatever we get, we love, we would like more of it. That's consumerism. What they're doing is engaging in politics. And that's, I think, what people are really mad about, is people are engaging. That accusation that there's an oversensitivity to university politics is older than I am. The complaint about political correctness in the university is not new at all, nor is it, I don't think, any worse now than it was 10, 20 years ago. But I think the politics may be getting more successful. And when those politics get more successful, when there's a like larger culture pushback against the kind of material that before we thought it may just college students would reject, now the wider culture is rejecting as racist or homophobic or Islamophobic. And when college students are able to sort of enforce their cultural will on the public by releasing embarrassing YouTube videos of people getting booed or whatever, I think that upsets people who are more established and have some skin in the game when it comes to the establishment system of comedy and performance.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of truth in what you're saying, but I think, again, so one sort of those two parts, I guess, if we were to tease them apart, to me it is radically different when someone like Chris Rock makes that criticism, because he's absolutely coming from a very different place politically and culturally, and that says something to me when he sort of has that complaint. And then the second part that I guess – and I would already make a distinction here. I think if somebody says, look, I don't want somebody like Condoleezza Rice to come here, you can agree or disagree with that, but there might be a substance. There's a real, like, you know, this was someone who was involved in the decision to invade Iraq, and I don't want her at my commencement. Is not real. That's less of like a she's going to advocate foreign policy I disagree with or say something that makes me feel uncomfortable. That might just be I object to a really disastrous and disingenuous and dishonest decision that she was involved in, is distinct again from, you know, Bill Maher is an asshole when he talks about Muslims, but I don't want him to be here at all. I mean, is that sort of shut down? And again, even from a consumer perspective, I mean, I think you're right. There is this model of consumers as sheep, but there's also consumers, getting relentlessly targeted and individually tailored to every sort of micro decision of their lives, being constantly placated and catered to through every aspect of their user experience on and offline. So in terms of those concerns, I mean, do you think that there is anything to that, or no, this is all just sort of more of the same phony freak out about political correctness?
Well, I think that I want to get to Chris Rock, because I think that's an interesting question about his politics. Because I went to a previous press screening of Top 5 in New York, mm-hmm. and everyone was super hyped. Everyone was really excited to see that movie. Chris Rock had done this amazing publicity tour where I think those remarks were probably on there.
Mm-hmm.
And the movie flopped. I mean, it did not do well. And you could see that was going to happen in the audience. And in particular, there was a character who was always catcalling. And it was just catcalling women, and it was clear that this was supposed to be funny in the movie, and it just did not land, not even close. There's not a laugh in the entire theater. Everyone felt super uncomfortable. And this is the press. These are the people who are going to be, like, deciding how this movie's going to go in a lot of ways. So I don't think it's just when we talk about college students or blaming college students, comedians sort of have an easy target for a change in cultural sensibilities because it might be the most dramatic in the college audience. But those are culture-wide and positive changes that are happening. I don't think the press audience for Top 5 that was super psyched to see it was looking for Chris Rock to be bad or to find something to admonish him for. Mm-hmm. I think it wasn't funny. It was...
And that's actually the question, right? Is it not landing because it's really not funny or because we've just decided now that this is a whole terrain that we cannot laugh about? I mean, and that's a trickier question, but it is a valid question, right? I mean, and we might be making the right decision politically or culturally that might not be the same right decision from the perspective of writing and performing comedy, which is another perspective that guys like Chris Rock articulate.
But I don't think those two things are as distinct as you or comedians might want to believe. I mean, why isn't that joke funny anymore? Why isn't it? If you watch comedies from the 90s, early 2000s, when I was growing up, mm-hmm. catcalling women was a standard backup guy characteristic. That's like what that guy did. It was funny. And here, the same move just did not get a laugh at all. And I think that's because people understand. Men especially understand better now than 10 years ago what the actual impact on people's lives is of relentless catcalling, and that it's not funny anymore because we have a better understanding of other people's experience. And I think that's a positive development, maybe not for comedians who have to make a film a year in advance, but for our culture and for funny jokes, I think that's a positive development.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, I know what you're talking about in some of those movies. And I always actually read it for me was that most of those characters, as you say, they were the backup guy and they were buffoonish. And, you know, it wasn't like getting positive results. Now, I agree that it was minimizing the actual experience of that harassment and of that, you know, reality, which has been much more clearly elucidated and is really important. But I think even in a lot of those, at least as I recall, it wasn't like this is something that we're valorizing in our comedy. We're mocking it. And I think that the concern that a smarter comedian would have is that we're going to, you know, you'll get to a zone where the realm of any type of play or satire is gone. And that's, you know, that's a tricky terrain because some people are just going to want to continue to make, you know, foul and stupid jokes. And then other people are going to want to play with tricky areas and see where it goes. And that's the nature of the medium.
Yeah, and people – and it should be and I think is in a lot of ways dominated by what works. And I hope that the what works changes. I mean, blackface got a lot of laughs at one time, and it doesn't anymore. People will boo you, at least in America, in most places. You won't be able to get away with it, and it won't be funny. And you won't be able to get away with it, not because people are looking to be offended, but because you're offensive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think those goalposts are constantly changing, but that's a good thing. And if comedians have to be constantly adjusting and be – if it presents more work for them than for other people, I think that's because they've had it easy for a long time and have had a lot of cheap material playing off people's prejudices.
All right. Well, there you have it, Malcolm Harris. It's an interesting debate. I think that the really fundamental issue that you're getting to, though, that I think kind of overrides all of this, regardless of your particular position on Chris Rock or the role of satire, where all of this goes, is that money as this sort of flattener of culture is the underlying dynamic. And I think that you brought that across really well. And I appreciate your time.
Thanks a lot, Michael.
Thank you. All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
You know, it's a little awkward, I got to say, because someone alerted me during the interview. I had no idea that apparently Sam and our guest had some type of beef on Twitter. Do you know anything about this?
Oh, this was back in – I think I remember that.
What happened?
Oh, it was some silly thing on Twitter back in, like, 2012.
So before I was even
I'm
here.
I'm looking it up now that you sent it to me. Yeah. It was silly.
Someone had a sharp eye. Was it like something, was it bad enough that I needed to like stop the interview to challenge, challenge Sam, you know, like, I mean, like defend Sam's honor?
No.
All right. All right. That's really funny though. I gotta say.
Worlds collide.
I just don't totally buy it. I think I gave him some good pushback. I'm not totally clear what my position is on all of this, but I don't think it's quite as simple as just, you know, everything is getting better and comedy has to work with that. But, you know, it's a fine line. Because this is what happens in these conversations. I talk with a guy like that, and I'm like, dude, Chris Rock is, you know, like, don't tell Chris Rock how to do his job. And then I go there, and then all of a sudden I see some idiot on Twitter who's like, yeah, I can't tell tranny jokes anymore. The world's over. And it's like, shut up, you bigoted moron.
There really isn't.
I don't know where to go.
Like, to me, at least, there really isn't any, like, defined rules to these things because it's all context. It's all what that joke is supposed to be doing. Like, you know, the thing is, like, I think.
Like, ultimately, the joke is supposed to be funny. Right. That's the tricky thing. It's like ultimately, like all this stuff is embedded in comedy, but a comedian's ultimate job is to be funny. Period.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Yes.
Like that's their job.
I mean, in my view, and again, this is an opinion of people who are usually, you know, progressive, or whatever, is that comedy should also, you know, punch up or have some specific, you know, meaning behind what the joke is or something.
But it can, yes.
Yeah.
But it's not
good comedy.
Ultimately the job of the comedian to do that.
Good comedy to me usually does. But ultimately, yes, I would agree that it's not, that specifically is not the comedian's job.
But the more complicated thing, and what I was trying to get to in that conversation, we'll get off in a second, I'll call Assemblyman Lesser, is but the more difficult thing is like not that. It's when you start getting comedians, again, like Chris Rock, or if you go back into anybody's catalog, George Carlin, any great comedian who, you know, they didn't set out like pedantically, like, I'm going to punch up and I'm going to undermine blah, blah, blah. They didn't do any of that, but they did. They absolutely were anti-war, anti-racist, but the way they did comedy was not like, if you were just sitting there looking for buzzwords and tropes to get offended by, you'd be offended all day and missed entirely the point.
Yes. No,
and Bill Burr's a lot like that too.
I think Bill Burr's
brilliant.
I think it has a lot to do. It has a lot to do with where the person's coming from in terms of like you said, with like George Carlin and Richard Pryor, like they didn't set out to specifically do that, but because of who they were,
that's right.
Like, because they wouldn't find. I mean, that classic George Carlin joke, for example. George Carlin didn't find rape to be funny, but he came up with a rape joke that made fun of rapists.
Right, but what I'm saying.
And like rape culture.
Absolutely,
I mean,
absolutely. I totally. But the thing is that when you get to a point where you can't even have that realm of that edge because you're so on a hair trigger. That's what guys like Chris Rock are talking about. And that's a real thing.
I mean, honestly, to me, the real problem with all this is never, oh, that joke crossed the line. To me, it's the people who want to make this edgy comedy and then complain when they piss people off.
Right.
I mean,
that's the other part of it.
That,
right,
to me, is the worst thing. Like, if you're out there making a rape joke, your point, I assume, is to offend, is to piss people off. I mean, you know that's why you're making that joke. And you know that the people who find it funny will find it funny, and the people who won't find it funny will come at you.
Well,
and then when you play the victim there and you go, oh, look at me, poor me. No, you gotta, when you are a comedian who makes that type of joke, you gotta own that. And I mean, I'm not saying it's gotta be a bad thing. I mean, the reason you're supposed to be good edgy comics own being that. They own the critique they get, the criticism they get, and they turn it into more material for themselves.
And sometimes there's comment, like, you know, Howard Stern to me, and, you know, obviously he's not as sort of relevant in a certain way anymore, but he's kind of like the classic example of a guy that, like, he was funny sometimes. And there was definitely some of his humor, I think sometimes he actually was really insightful, but some of that dude's humor is not in any way socially productive.
But you know what?
But there's it's
a,
funny.
There's a huge difference between funny. How he's looked at, though, and how people who try to do what he does.
Well, because they suck. And that's what the comedians would say. They're not funny.
Yes. That's
it's not that they're wrong and coming from a bad place. They're just not good.
But you know what? I also think they do, though. Like, for example, like Opie and Anthony tried to do a lot of the things Howard Stern did.
Well, they were just knocking
But they did it. Like you would say what you want about Howard Stern. And, like, he's, you know.
They
but,
don't have Howard's sensitivity or intelligence at all.
The dude's got good, like, say what you want about some of his humor, but the dude's got a good background in terms of his politics, his feelings on things. Pretty good, at least.
I think he
cares about a lot of issues.
He has a certain
honest.
Sophistication that a lot of his knockoffs do not have.
Exactly.
No doubt. You're totally right about that. All right. We're going to be right back with Matt Lesser. We could talk about that all day. That's really interesting. But we're going to take a brief break. And we're going to come right back and we're going to talk about the what you do with your student loans after you've been watching all this bad comedy at college campuses. Oh, man, I had such a good transition. Oh, it was so good. I'm just messing with you.
Here we go.
All right, we'll be right back.
Rastafi own banks and enterprise. So me nah stop chanting, my soul enters Zion. Princes of fire, Babylon me tell you your time just expire. What kind of wickedness me a your transpire? And no gasoline and a tire, eternal fire. Nothing Babylon you ever get bruised. Me a want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going lose. We a want. And I come for Sanya, let me show them says all fish and I come from Anya. That fish they come a far away, they bring him all the way from Norway. Hey, I could rust and them a try for trick or that can be my national dish of eternal fire. When the people feel and you walk again, me I want them fire. I said they just can't win, you're going to lose. Can you kill a one them move? I beg your back up and go. Every time you hear about Africa, a shackles and chains. Tell me why you try to corrupt the little Rastaman brain. And if you tell the youth, them say Africa exists long before the middle passes. Me come to tell you, get the youth, them for white, because Babylon a brainwash the masses a fire. And dirty Babylon, you will go get bruised. We are born them fire. I said, they just can't win, you're going to lose. Up and down, me a beg you move.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is State Representative Matthew Lesser from the great state of Connecticut. Congressman, how are you? Representative Lesser, how are you?
I'll take the promotion. I'm doing great, Michael. How are you?
Well, let's get you that promotion soon. I should say, for full disclosure, we've been friends for 10, 12 years now. It's kind of crazy, actually.
Yeah, quite a while, and it's great to see you talk to you again, and I'm a huge fan of the show.
Oh, awesome! I really appreciate you coming on. And I wanted to talk to you because you know you really and it's just been incredibly impressive and fun to watch as a friend and as someone who cares about this stuff. You've really been working at the state level in Connecticut on some really, really important and kind of core progressive issues, including student debt relief, student loan issues. You authored a student loan bill of rights, which passed in Connecticut. I want to get to that, but first let's talk about how this issue is sort of featuring in this year's Democratic primary for president. Obviously, a Bernie Sanders, very much progressive. But you also have, and you know, we're quite sympathetic to him on this show, but you also have Hillary Clinton really trying to make a push on these issues as well. And I just would like your perspective as a progressive state legislator on how these issues have got sort of pushed to the center of the Democratic Party?
It's been really amazing to watch, and as somebody who's still pretty young, I'm 32, looking out at my generation and the folks behind me, it's clear that this is the number one economic issue that's facing Americans of a certain age. And it's gratifying to see the three top Democratic candidates, you mentioned Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, also Martin O'Malley,
right,
all working to deal with this issue. The president made it a cornerstone of his State of the Union when he called for a free community college across the country, and states are leading. But, you know, the candidates right now are competing to see who can have the boldest, most achievable plans to ensure debt-free college for Americans. And I think competition is great, and I'm excited to see the, you know, my party continuing to fight to address this critically important issue. I mean, this year in Connecticut, graduates are graduating with an average of over $30,000 in debt, and to start out your life like that just closes doors. It limits options. It prevents people from starting up companies or quitting jobs and doing something crazy. It's a shackle that is just, you know, impacting everybody, almost everybody I know, everybody of my generation.
Absolutely. So, you know, work us backwards a little bit. You've done a tremendous amount of work on this in Connecticut. I want to get to some, you'll tell us some specifics. What first got you on this issue? Because this is an example of listening to peers and friends. Because one of the other things that sort of is striking about this is that this is the first, you know, people talked about, okay, President Obama kind of activated young people as a constituency. And young people have been involved in different important protest movements and some social organizing around, you know, Occupy Wall Street and some other things. But in some ways, the student debt issue is the sort of the first kind of, like, you know, it's almost like the Medicare or the Social Security of the younger generation. It's this very kind of bare bones, direct, practical thing where the interests of a certain generation and the political trajectory of it really, really intersect. And, you know, and again, you started working on this before it was, you know, you helped bring it to the point where it is now. So what was the impetus behind it, and how did you start organizing on it?
Well, I think the part of it was how I got elected to office. You know, I defeated a longtime Republican incumbent who worked in the Nixon White House, who's about 50 years older than me. And I was elected by a group of college and high school students and recent graduates who just felt that their voices, this was in 2008, the same year Barack Obama got elected, and I'd been working on the Obama campaign and quit to run for office myself. And, you know, I was propelled by a group of young people who felt that government wasn't listening to them and their legislature wasn't listening to them. And so, you know, since then, I've really felt that it's my job to try to speak for people who aren't having their voices heard in state government. At the beginning of this year, I was appointed chair of Connecticut's Banking Committee. And when I was trying to figure out what we were going to do, the thought occurred to me that, you know, rather than focusing on many of the other issues, I mean, we did focus on a lot of other issues, payday lending and whatnot, but you know, this is more than just a higher education issue. This is really a financial issue. It goes
right
to the heart of our financial system. I think we need to stop thinking about this as simply, you know, higher education. It's really about our economy as a whole. And so I decided that student loan reform would be the centerpiece of, you know, my agenda as chair of the committee. And I'm just gratified by the huge coalition we were able to build of labor and consumer groups and students, and that we were able to get it passed, and the Student Loan Bill of Rights in just a few months.
Tell us briefly what's actually in the Student Loan Bill of Rights and how it could sort of fit, you know, in the broader national agenda, and really in some respects, it's a key bridge in the fight. I mean, it's part of several pillars, I think, in any kind of real holistic fight against the mass inequality crisis we're in.
So one of the things that I've heard from just about everybody who's stuck paying off student loans is just how horrible the experience of dealing with loan servicers are. These are these private companies that the federal government and private lenders hire to service loans. These are the people you write the checks to. And there are only a handful. Companies like Navient dominate the market, and they are a nightmare to deal with. They lose people's loans. If you want to prepay your loan, they won't allow you to do it. They find ways to charge the absolute maximum amount. And so what we're doing is, for the first time, we are regulating all of those servicers on the state level. We're requiring them to submit to state regulation and adhere to certain standards. And if they don't, they won't be allowed to collect loans in the state of Connecticut. In addition to that, we're creating a one-stop shop, an ombudsman for student loans. So anybody, family, student, a borrower, or somebody who's struggling to find out an affordable option if they're already paying back their loans, can call up this office, ask for help, get navigated through the system. And they're also preparing financial education materials for students who are going off to college or graduate school so they can understand issues like loan deferral and forgiveness and find the most affordable options. So that's one thing that we're doing. The other thing we're doing is we listened to Senator Elizabeth Warren, who talked about how immoral it is that government is making a profit off of student loans. And just as the federal government is lending out at rates that are far higher than they are borrowing at, the state of Connecticut is as well. We were borrowing at under 3%, and we were lending out at 7%, which was just an obscene rate of profit that we were making off of student loans. So we passed a law that directed our state student loan issuer to close that gap. They've already lowered the rates by almost 2 percentage points and make and also refinance existing loans when people are stuck in higher interest rates, because you know rates are much lower now than they were a few years ago.
That's great work. And as we wrap up this conversation, what I'm curious about, I mean, you mentioned, and I know, you know, from being a friend of yours and sort of seeing your entry into politics, but also this work on this issue. I mean, what's the lesson that people can take about working at a local and state level to start driving the next, you know, progressive agenda, basically?
Well, I think the lesson is that if you want to wait for John Boehner and Mitch McConnell to get this, you're going to wait until you keel over.
Congress has done. They don't look so healthy. No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
Oh. Well, I'm not a doctor.
I know it's the kind of joke that you probably shouldn't laugh at, but I will still make it. Go ahead.
He's looking a little orange these days.
A little bit.
But the point is that, you know, Congress has been nothing but a roadblock. But, you know, it's possible for states to lead on this stuff. That's why Tennessee and Oregon are giving out free community college to everybody in their states. And, you know, the states are still places where a lot of policies made where you have bipartisan consensus in some places. And that's why groups like the Koch brothers are pouring money into trying to take over state legislatures, because, you know, although they have been able to bottle a lot of stuff up on the federal level, you know, progressive states are really making a huge difference. And we're fighting against Congress. You know, Congress actually has a law that says that states can't refinance federal student loans. I mean, they have erected roadblocks. They are trying to prevent us from offering debt relief to the federal government from offering debt relief to victims of the for-profit colleges. They are nothing but a problem, but we're still able to get stuff through. And just as Massachusetts led on healthcare reform, the states are now leading on student loan reform.
Well, it's great work, and I really, really appreciate your time. That's State Representative Matthew Lesser from the great state of Connecticut. My friends, I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
Oh, appreciate it. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
So President Obama is headed to Alaska, and he has pissed off conservatives for doing yet another horrible, terrible thing that we all know President Obama has become. It's become vintage of him to do. Classic Obama. What is Obama doing? He is taking the name Mount McKinley and he's changing it to what it once was previously called, and that is Denali. Oh my God.
Wow.
Basically, Obama announced that he's going to rename Mount McKinley Denali, using his executive power to restore an Alaska native name with deep cultural significance to the tallest mountain in North America. This was a name that was used for hundreds of years by the natives of Alaska. And Obama's spending his trip in Alaska, also other things he's doing there, he's spending 3 days promoting aggressive action to combat climate change. And he is addressing, he's going to take a series of steps to address the concerns of Alaska Native tribes, which means this small token of renaming the mountain what it was called previously is a good first step. Now, conservatives are pissed about it. We got Rob Portman tweeting how, "I'm disappointed with the administration's decision to change the name of Mount McKinley in Alaska. President McKinley was a proud Ohioan, and the mountain was named after him as a way to remember his rich legacy after his assassination." Now, for those of you who don't know, McKinley was a president. He was assassinated 6 months into his office, and he never visited Alaska. So what I have to say is, if the right-wingers in Ohio are so pissed about this, why don't they name something in Ohio after him? I'm sure they have, but why not just name another thing after him? Because I know the deeply historical significance, and this is completely true, by the way, of why the Denali was renamed Mount McKinley back in the late 1800s, which was a gold prospector was exploring the Alaska Range, heard that Mr. McKinley had won the Republican presidential nomination, and declared that the mountain should now be named Mount McKinley in honor as a show of support. That's for real, by the way. I mean, that is the historical significance of Mount McKinley being named Mount McKinley. That's just unbelievable. And then in 1917... the government formally recognized the name. And then since 1975, there had been a movement in Alaska to rename it. In 1980, they named the national park surrounding it Denali National Park and Preserve, but the mountain continued to be called Mount McKinley. And then recently, Senator Lisa Murkowski, who you might know as a Republican of Alaska, introduced legislation to rename the peak Denali. So you have Republicans in Alaska even saying this mountain should be called Denali. And Ohio lawmakers blocked the move. I mean, this is the small government states' rights party, isn't it? I mean, this is supposed to be, you know, we don't want the federal government telling the states what to do. And here you have Republicans in Ohio telling even Republicans of Alaska what they should be doing in their state. Well, God damn it, Obama. How dare you listen to not only the natives of Alaska wanting their mountain called what it had been called for generations, but you're also falling for the what the Republicans in Alaska want. Ugh, how dare you, Obama. Disgusting.
All right, everybody, we're going to head into the fun half of the program where you can join us at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920.
What's that number?
646-257-3920.
646-257-3920.
Am I wrong?
No, you're right.
Oh, okay.
I just wanted to repeat it as much as possible.
Oh, okay. All right, got you. I might get to one of these old pieces of sound. Matt has a bunch for you. We're going to have a fun second half.
A very fun second half.
And let me tell you something. I'm not really inviting this because I'm actually getting as sick of this conversation.
If you have a problem with Sam Harris, Michael would like to talk
to
you.
No, I would not like to talk to you. I just would like to let you know, being honest, that this is probably like, while I'm here, that's when you could talk about it. Because I think Sam
just doesn't care.
Like, done.
He looks at it now like he looks at Gamergate.
Yes, and I do too, actually. That's how unbelievable you people have become. The minutia and the nonsense.
Well, I'm telling you, if you look at a Venn diagram, there is some major.
Well, I wrote a piece, actually, comparing those two positions. All right, everybody. Become a member today.
Join themajorityreport.com. Support this show by becoming a member. You can also support this show by doing all your Amazon shopping through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. Excuse me. Majorityreportkickback.com. You will notice no difference at all, except when you go to that site or click the link on majority.fm, we will get a small percentage from Mr. Bezos when you make your Amazon purchase. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee and chocolates. Use coupon code MAJORITY to get 10% off your entire order. That's a win-win-win if you ask us here at the Majority Report. What else? Follow us on Twitter at MajorityFM. Like us on Facebook, Facebook.com/TheMajorityReport. Go to our Reddit page and subscribe there, Reddit.com/r/TheMajorityReport. What else? DonateYourAccount.com. You could donate your Facebook and Twitter accounts. We will share one story.
Write us a review on iTunes.
That one is very important.
That's a big deal. Yes. All right, everybody. We'll see you in the fun half. And there's a caller. We'll get to you as soon as we're on the fun half.